All right. I'm Ben Capronis from the Division of Viral Hepatitis, and I'm here to talk about the work that we're doing. And so some of the objectives today, I think my very first objective is to keep you from falling asleep since it's almost lunchtime and you want to get out of here. So I'll do my best to refrain from dad jokes because I have young kids and they really enjoy those. So overall, we're going to talk about the work that the Division of Viral Hepatitis is doing for the NMI project. And in doing so, we'll go through a little bit of how we go about collecting the data, how we've standardized it, and how we plan to manage it. All righty. So currently we get two streams of data coming into DVH, Division of Viral Hepatitis. And so the net stream was set up in the mid-90s, and it hasn't been updated since then. So wherever the state of surveillance for hepatitis in the mid-90s was, that's that stream coming in. The NEDS base system uses a more current case report form, so it has more extended data. And in order to get the things that we really need, which is our surveillance reports, then we map the NEDS base data to the NETS data so that we can have consistent data across the entire country, because that's really what we want to do. CDC is all about the entire country and not individual states. And so the next stream, which is what I'm going to be talking about, is a new HL7 stream that's coming in. And let's go on. These are the conditions that we collect. We, Division of Viral Hepatitis collects all this. Let's see. Going off the cuff so far. All right. And one of the reasons why we're involved in the NMI project is because of our the number of cases coming in. The data dump that Sandy talked about, the NDAP program, is a dump of a whole bunch of data from all the reportable conditions, not HIV. So don't get upset. And so these hepatitides account for almost 10% of them. And so by bringing on hepatitis guides, then we get that low-hanging fruit. All right. And so this is a broad overview of, don't get bogged down that I'm going to go way back to prehistoric times. But the process of developing a message mapping guide. So we start with our case report form. The case report forms, in our case, were developed in the mid-2000s. And what CCELS does is they go through and they identify all the concepts on our case report form, and then they put those in a message mapping guide. So the process of developing this case report form, we get input from the epidemiologists and everybody in the Division of Viral Hepatitis, and we also get input from states and CSCE and our stakeholders. If you didn't put a lot of input into our current form, it might have been because when we started the NMI project, we really wanted to get this form from being used to implementation. So we took what we had and we gave it to, threw it over the fence to CCELS, and then they started the project. And I've been very adamant in the 5 years that we've been working on this project that that case report form does not change at all. Because if I change my form, then it makes their life more difficult. And so one of the issues with that is that things on the case report form or in NMI might be a little bit out of date. There have been changes to the laboratory testing, the way definitions the way our definitions are, and so they're not exactly represented in the form, but we can make do. So one of the things, last year there was a statement, CSD statement, on the new definitions for hepatitis C, and they included probable cases. So NMI already collected information on probable, And so rather than change our form completely, we just are using that other variable to accommodate the new definitions. All right, so this you can't read. And you don't really need to read it. All you need to know is that CDC is 14,000 people. And this is standardization and harmonization context of this. So Division of Viral Hepatitis is 100 people, and we're there. And the other presenters on the stage are in those highlighted areas. And so the important thing to get out of this is that we have three programs here which are collaborating and on this project, which we don't usually talk to each other. But we're collaborating on this project and working to standardize and harmonize all of these things. And the other thing to get out of this is that CCELS, who's providing all of the resources for this, is in a completely different division, because CDC is based on diseases rather than on the technical skills that we need. And so when we want to standardize and harmonize these data elements, you have to think that for hepatitis, where we're that little highlighted thing down there that you can't see, we have 100 people in hepatitis that can't agree. And then we have 50 state partners, and they don't all agree. And then we have CSDE, and then we have our external state partners, stakeholders like dialysis centers or blood banks. And so pulling all these people together to agree on just hepatitis and how hepatitis should be surveilled is an issue. And then when you go across all of the different areas at CDC to try to harmonize every single one of our data elements, it really gets onerous. Okay. I don't think I breathed there for 5 minutes. All right. So the basic process of harmonizing. So we have a message mapping guide from 2007 that was based on the old way that CDC collected data and implemented guides. So that doesn't really include generic version 2. You've heard generic version 2 a lot up here, and I'm going to talk a little bit about why it's important. So generic version 2 is a part of every single guide. So it's a part of Sandy's guide, it's a part of the of Hillard's guides, and so it is all the demographic information, it's all everything that's common to all the different guides. And then their extended extended elements are in our disease-specific guides. And so the impact of generic version 2. So I did a quick and dirty analysis back in 2014, looking at that old guide compared to the new guide. And what the new guide showed was that the way CCELS was thinking about developing the guides in 2007 is a lot different than the way they are now. And so I should point out that the guide in 2014 came out before the CSTE position on standardization and harmonization. So CDC was already doing standardization and harmonization. And so the hepatitis guide has fewer data elements. There's fewer concepts that are only hepatitis. And the generic part of the guide accounts for almost 40% of our guide. And you can see the decline in the data elements, how that goes. All right. So another part of harmonization is having CCELS do it. So the generic version 2, all of our programs are using CCELS to develop these guides. So common technical people, they have common sets of names. So, I mean, they have developed the framework for developing these guides. And since we're all using them, then we're going to use all the same data elements. And so date ranges and all that stuff is going to be represented the same way. And so going back to generic, we have about 132 conditions, 98 of them are notifiable, and 58, about 52 of them, have no extended data elements. So you can see all these conditions can be transmitted with generic only. And so that's why Leslie Ann's slide of the bar chart had a big, huge slice that was, we got this. So they went for the low-hanging fruit, which was all the conditions that have no extended data elements, and they are making huge strides that way in, you know, just checking the stuff off. All right. So back in, so right now we're going through piloting hepatitis because because I haven't, all right, I'll hurry a little bit then. No, not too bad. So hepatitis is piloting it. We're using non-NBS as well as NBS states to do this. We've developed some of the forms with the NETS base system. Talk about that later. And so we started a piloting of message mapping guide in the fall of 2014. It was a really good guide back then, and the main feedback from that was that states wanted to be able to send ELR data, the laboratory data, as well as questions that were similar to the ELR data, but in an EPI form, so non-coded laboratory data. And this was such a great idea that we extended it to vaccine. So this is our project that we're working on right now. This is the data management that hepatitis is doing. Leslie Ann pointed this out. She's already talked about this. This is the basic data flow. It goes from the state. I like to think about this as databases. So it goes from databases at the state. HL7 is basically a database. It goes to the FinMS queue, which is a SQL database, and then it goes to the MVPS processing database, and then the provisioning database, where the programs pick it up, and then we can analyze it. And so this is the database diagram for our provisioning database. And you can't see it, and I, as an EPI, have a hard time being able to use this because there's so many tables. So we started a project in which we would develop a data mart. And the main part of this is, the main reason why this is so complicated is because CCELs decided that to ease their development, they would use name value pairs. So rather than have completely different databases for every single program, they're putting everything into one database, and we can access it that way and use it how we need. So, So these are some of the successes we've had. We've been able to understand it. We've been able to set up the hardware. We've syncing the data from the MVPS provisioning database. And so NCHHSTP is helping Division of Viral Hepatitis set all this up, because Division of Viral Hepatitis doesn't have the expertise to do this. And they're doing a great job. And they're working with the MVPS folks to identify some errors, too. And so some of the barriers that we've had, we started this project developing this database back in the fall. And some of the barriers that we've had is that MVPS provisioning database has continued to change. We've also had the MVPS has had difficulty standing up the onboarding and production environments. We've noticed a few problems with the relationship diagrams, ERDs, of the MVPS provisioning database, which caused them to have to go back. And long story short is that we haven't been able to get real data into that database to do a lot of our testing. And so hopefully today, there's a build being deployed that will fix the hierarchical problems with the database. And some of the other things that we're doing, we confirmed the test data. The ways we can do this is replicating the counts of You send a bolus of data to us, and we can replicate those counts between the NETS data stream and the HL7 data stream. We would like to do dual streams of both the NETS data and the HL7 data, but CSELS has told us that we can't do that. Instead, we have to transition over to the HL7 data stream. So in lieu of that, we're going to do ad hoc reports to states to make sure that the data is good in the data coming in, as well as the new data coming in through the new stream. And we also help and test. And it's kind of scary working on this project for new programs coming in, because they don't know what to expect. So we hold other programs' hands and say it's going to be all right when they freak out with all the technical jargon. And thank you very much.
So there's a microphone right there for questions, and I get moderator. Do you want a hard one or an easy one? Let's do this one. So I mentioned earlier that yesterday we spent an entire day working on electronic case reporting. 2 years ago in Nashville, we spent an entire day working on NMI with the CFT program. And to quote somebody from that day, I would like to kill NETS, and I still want to kill NETS, right? But I think a couple of things came to mind when you folks were speaking. I'll probably finish with a question. One is that when we're doing electronic case reporting, we're told pretty explicitly that we cannot ask for things that are not available. And so I think that creating variables for the purpose of doing this is probably a mistake. We have to be very, very cautious about doing that. So just keep that in mind when you put your message guides together. I think that the solution is not, I get the temporary solution of taking a NETS or an HL7 transmission and downgrading it to NETS, but that doesn't solve the kind of core problem that CST has been trying to address, and that is if we give the information, it should be available to the programs. And with that in mind, I've been hearing the story about the CDC platform and infrastructure support that's being increased and a significant amount of money that's going to support the CDC platform. Is that the same thing as the surveillance platform? Okay. So I hope that you guys are on the front line of getting those dollars, because I know that part of the issue has been with the program folks. So can you speak to how you're going to prioritize the infrastructure dollars in support of the CDC platform for this project?
So the CDC platform work, or the surveillance platform, or the surveillance data services platform, it's changing names, they haven't nailed them down yet, is being done out of the Office of Public Health. I'm going to stumble over the name. Okay, Scientific Services. Which Chesley Richards manages. And they are in an overarching role that works on infrastructure for the whole agency. So that's why they're looking at it. The intent is, they got a special grant, and these are, they got special funds from the federal government that can be used for one-time projects that are non-recurring expenses. And they wanted to use it to try to build this infrastructure. The concept is something that is intended to complement the CDC, the community platform that those of you who were involved yesterday heard about. The thought is that there's some infrastructure that needs to be modernized at CDC. Some of that would be things that would provide tools that would be used broadly by the public health community. Some of them are tools that would go onto or be part of that community platform. Some of them are more things where CDC needs to be able to have these tools to operate more effectively, like ways to process messages when they come in. So that money is being planned for and organized. We hope that some of the things that we're developing will become part of that platform. We hope that some of the things that are being developed for that platform are tools that we can use, so that it will become more of an integrated CDC type of a solution. And they're looking at a variety of different strategies right now. There was a big meeting They had representation from each of the centers at CDC, and Sandy and I both sat on that group, as well as the informatics people from Sandy's division, or Sandy's center, and the where hepatitis and STD and HIV and PD are, as well as a bunch of other people. And so they really did look at CDC priorities in the big picture to advance how we do surveillance, how we get data in from outside partners, how we get data back out to outside partners. And so it was really encouraging because people really came together, were thinking big picture, were looking outside their own interests, and were trying to figure out what was the infrastructure we needed in place. And I have to tell you that repeatedly, how does it help the jurisdictions? How does it help healthcare? Came up because people were looking for how do we build a big picture solution or lots of pieces that will actually help to come up with a bigger picture solution. It really is service oriented, so we're not building a monolith, we're building interchangeable pieces that people can use as they need a purpose, and they will be easier to replace when we need to update technology and that kind of thing. So I guess, Jim, to answer your question, none of that money is getting handed directly to us, but we think it is going to build infrastructure that we will be able to take advantage of and use.
It helps. I think you should probably go after more money, though. Go for it, Bill.
Hi.
Okay.
Hoga Chen from New York State. I vote for that. We want more money. Okay, I have one question, one comment. My question is, the New York State is one of the pilot states, so we are sending next generic, we are working with generic V1, ARBONET, TB, so four formats. And we are working on the generic V1 in the ARBO 1.3. So my question is, when we get in production for V1, can we kill NETs?
So when you go into production with a generic version 2 message,
right,
it will cover 52 of those conditions. But there's another set of 11 conditions that still need to have messages built in that format that starts with the version 2 message. But like Ben said, that generic message captures the ones that don't need extended data. If you just started sending all of your data there, all those programs with extended data that they really depend on would lose out on. So we can't have you just turn it off at this point. We are trying to get those 11 extra diseases incorporated into the format that uses generic V2 as the core. But those other 11 programs are ones who said, no, that generic message by itself is not enough for us. We can't work that way because we'd lose really fundamental data. So we can't have you just turn it off at this point.
Okay, so this is really a lot of resource for the state. I can understand this is complicated because each program wants a different data. So my comment, when you show you are going through different disease for the message mapping guide, for example, we are EIP. So we have ABC, it's a group of disease. They can be doing one message mapping guide instead of disease-specific mapping guide. Because when we start with the pilot, we realize, we really appreciate the TA. It's really helping us to keep focused. But each one, we have to go through the process, disease by disease, and then that's a lot of resource. I have to have one person doing full-time to work on this pilot. So if you are talking about this different disease, each one, even though it's getting easier in the future once you have that one done, but then still each one goes through the same process. You go start doing the mapping guide and then with the Excel spreadsheet with the field, and then go through onboarding process of this end-to-end testing. So my recommendation is if you can group as many diseases as possible with one mapping guide, will save your time and our time, and then maybe we can reach to really to turn off the nets soon.
And we definitely look for those opportunities to group diseases. With the arboviral, we were getting about 29 event codes in there. There is some work that the foodborne disease and waterborne folks are doing where they're looking at the common elements between their diseases. And they're hoping that they can help us put together a guide that would pull together a lot of those. So hopefully that is an area where we're going to be able to do some consolidation.
In the same vein, you mentioned working on a Zika message guide. This week, you know that we're doing a position statement on the Zika virus, and have you, is your message guide being informed by that work as well?
So the position statement that the executive board put out in the late winter came at a really opportune time for us. We were able to incorporate all those data elements into the arboviral 1.3 guide that is out and available for people to use. We have been trying to look at the new guide, and it looks like almost everything that will be captured there, so it really won't involve any more changes, we don't think. The challenge is going to be that classification of infection. So right now it calls for confirmed, probable, and infection for both the congenital cases and the non-congenital cases. And that's something that I really would encourage that we give serious consideration to, because it's nobody right now has that in as a disease category. And if you needed a confirmed infection versus a probable infection, we're kind of setting precedent that would go into the future. We've had lots of consternation over the last few weeks looking at that and trying to figure out how it would be handled. So I hope we give thought to it. But the arboviral guide handles the Zika stuff, and it looks like it will continue to handle it. We just have to address that issue.
So I'm just a little slow. I actually wanted to sort of follow on the question about the surveillance platform. I find platforms and those words are just floating around all over the place. And the way I just thought I'd share the way I understand and keep some of this on the street. The surveillance platform is meant to be a place for shared services, and it's not program specific. And so the CDC programs and partners, large groups, I'm not responsible for how all the groups were pulled together to discuss, but the idea was to identify sort of extensible services that would help programs and jurisdictions and other partners do surveillance. Not money to one program for one program's good. And so I'll give you an example, routing, secure data exchange, and one of my personal favorites, the idea of repositories for variables and valid values. We're called to harmonize and standardize, but if we're always, are we looking at Ben, and we're looking at Lloyd and Snowman and OBS, all of whatever the right code sets are. And we actually don't have a repository for that. Those are examples. The process discussion started out with over 80 concepts for shared services. And then it went down to like 40 and I don't know, 20 minutes to say, and 10. And I think those priorities or those ideas are presented by OPIS, the group that manages the surveillance platform. But I hope that helps you understand this isn't like a platform where data goes. This is a shared space for, hey, I need that book out of the library. I need, can I maybe use this? And so in a way, the idea of voting for additional funding and additional human resources to get work done, if my center had a repository where I said I need to know about how to ask favorite color, and I didn't have to spreadsheet it manually myself, I would do a much better job, and it would be a lot more efficient and waste less of your time chasing that around.
If you want your platform to float around, you should just put it in the cloud.
My head is in the cloud. Hi, Jillian Haney from Massachusetts. Apropos of the recent challenges that states have had in reporting to CDC around Zika, I was wondering more globally if you had discussions about how states can streamline reporting on emerging infections so that we are not faced with scrambling with spreadsheets and reporting it to multiple different agencies in multiple different formats, and if there was going to be a more broader discussion on emergency response reporting activities.
See, I didn't have that hard one.
I don't know that we have a short-term solution. Certainly, as we move forward, we're hoping that the type of infrastructure we're building is going to be something that's going to be flexible enough, that and that the message will be standard enough that we can be able to say, hey, use the standard format, here's, you know, the data elements, you guys know where they go, here's the lab section, here's the vaccine section, here's the whatever section, and that you'll be able to put it together pretty quickly and get data in that way, and that as we build these services, they will allow us to more quickly and effectively work with the data and move it around and get it to the people who need it. So we're talking about those routing things internally. It will always be a challenge, I think, in to be responsive to emergencies. So
I think we really understand that, but it was very disappointing for us, all the big group, to see that there was a more coordinated effort across the EC in response to people reporting this and trying to do that. And it would be great if we felt to take ownership of how to respond to COVID reporting and emergencies, create a standard about how we do that, make sure that
I'm just going to try to very briefly recap what Jillian said. I'm sure I won't quite get the gist of it, but that it is a challenge to the jurisdictions to handle these emergency events as they come up and all the data for it, and that we need to find a more coordinated way across CDC and to have more standards so that it is more easily implementable, and that potentially CCELS could take a leadership role in helping.
Lieutenant Commander Thornton asked for HHS. A question kind of following on the question here about the potential use outside of domestic and interjurisdictional within the nation, when establishing the infrastructure and the requirements and creating the repository, is there any context about the discussion of assurances and the agreements of how that information, not just the requirements that would need to be shared, but in sort of a broader scope, the understanding of the legalities and how that information could be used, even if you really don't know how it would be used because the emergency hasn't yet presented those caveats in the language that in certain instances, that way you don't have to go back case by case to state level or local level to get the approval for information to sort of break that glass ceiling from a national position.
Right now, the authority under which this data is reported is really the agreement of the states to send it as a CSTE, you know, based on the CSTE position statement, and there's that kind of that agreement to send it forward. There is some data that is advanced to WHO. Generally, you know, the data coming to CDC has the identifiers removed. There are a few diseases where there are exceptions, and generally going to WHO, it's the appropriate information going there. You know, I think when it comes to how should this deep data be used in other ways, it really does need to come back to an organization like CSTE to say, you know, we're handing on this data and figure out what those appropriate decisions are. I appreciate the idea of making some of those decisions up front, coming to common understandings so that when we get to an emergency situation, it's not a matter of convening it. And certainly CSTE would be the group to work through to develop that kind of consensus.
Andy's going to have the last question.
Oh, that's this is a little bit off topic of the other questions. We had a wonderful conversation with you guys a few weeks ago from New York City to talk about moving forward with this press. And when I know that the emphasis is on timely notification for almost all the conditions, and I certainly applaud that. But the concern we have is what happens if we notify you in an automated fashion, and then you announce something that our own jurisdiction has not announced publicly. So I'm just wondering, what are your policies around using the data and making any of it public, and how are you going to collaborate with the jurisdictions to ensure that you don't do something that we're not ready for?
And so maybe I can make a general statement, and then the more programmatic people can make statements too. With NNDSS, with our publication, we're still on that nice weekly schedule, and the team that you guys probably get calls from, it's our data operations team, they're the ones who actually put together the MMWR table. They really do make a point of calling back to the jurisdictions on anything that seems like it's a sensitive condition and confirming before they publish that. We are intending to continue that. We would like to move to a point, though, where when the data comes in, it can be made available online at some appropriate level for more interactive analysis, not those very fixed tables. But what kind of a time frame is appropriate for that? What kind of validation and verification needs to go on before it's published is, again, still something that needs to be decided. And I really think that's the kind of thing that we need to address with the SDE, because it is your data and we need to have that sense of things. But obviously, if the data is coming in more frequently, because we're encouraging people not to wait till the end of the week to do your notifications, but to send them more approximately, the programs may be acting and following up and initiating some closer action on it. So maybe I can let the folks here who are from the programs talk about how they might do it.
So how about that? So vaccine preventable and respiratory, and probably things like flu and measles and rubella, maybe polio infection, something like that. I mean, we only get data from NETS once a week, you know, provisioned that way. So I don't think NMI kind of conversation right now affects that. Could we publish something or share something that wasn't quite ready for prime time would be really because of something that happened more quickly through NMI. I think for our center, that kind of advanced information we have that we need to be careful not to share outside of the framework of what the jurisdictions want would be from phone calls. You know, I mean, we've got a measles, this kind of thing. And I think strategically, it's our plan to continue making sure that all the jurisdictions that provide that information are comfortable with what we would put either on our website. And very recently, we had republished our data sharing and data access guidance, you know, based on, what, 2-3 years ago, the call from CSTE. So jurisdictions are now aware of our, you know, the framework under which we would publish data. And that actually there were some, you know, Jeff and Janet had advised me through a very recent example of where we were actually given a FOIA to present information outside of the framework of our agreement with the jurisdictions, and we would not do that without making sure that we had communicated that. The model of addressing that will not change based on how quickly we get data this way.
And likewise for SDBs, we do not single out any individual states, any publications that we have not previously discussed with that state, and that's been our general policy over time, and that won't change with NMI. That's happening. The data we make queryable on our center atlas is data that's already been published in surveillance reports.
Okay, I think that's it. I am really hungry, so I'd like to thank all of you so much. And Michelle, particularly, our TA experience has been wonderful. The APHL folks have been great. Your team's been great. We love working with you. I think my staff is, you know, we didn't get any money for it, but I think my staff is better for the experience. So thank you very much. Thanks, everybody, for coming.